Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming along to the last concurrent for the day, and we'll have a fitting finish as we look to the future and think about how we face that differently. Today's speakers are Kuan Yi Tan. Kuan Yi is a pricing actuary at TAL. She's responsible for supporting the AA in essentially drawing out the key issues in product pricing and reinsurance. She has over 6 years of experience in the insurance industry with both corporate and consulting environments in Australia and Southeast Asia. Our second speaker is Wei Hao Chow. Wei Hao is an actuary at EY Financial Services. He has a PhD in actuarial science. Wei Hao has published a number of papers around innovative approaches to analysis, independence, capital, and diversification benefits. He has advised a number of insurers and reinsurers on risk and capital management issues, as well as risk appetite, risk assessment, capital projection, and stress testing. Wei Hao is passionate about changes and the future and always looks forward to new and better ways to solve practical problems. I'll now hand over shortly to our speakers. They'll deliver the presentation in the usual format, and then we'll hopefully have a good question and answer session at the end. When you do come up, please speak into the microphones and state your name and organisation that you work for. That way we capture all the Q&A for the recording. So without taking up any more time, I'll hand over to our speakers. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us here today. So, just a brief outline of the objectives of our session. Both Wei Hao and I, we are interested in things that we can do. Sorry, I'm a bit short. And changes we can affect to make insurance right. More and more, we are seeing the necessity of making insurance right for the customers to make sure that we do not get left behind as an industry. And more importantly, to make sure that customers do not lose sight of how insurance will help them in their own overall personal financial management. So I'll start off today by talking about the things other companies are doing, which we could learn from. Wei Hao will then be setting the scene and discussing some food for thought based on insurance operations the way they are right now. We will then tie these two together by going through some proposed ideas that can be brought to life. Some of what we are proposing will be quick wins, and some companies in Australia are already doing it or in early stages of doing them, and some others will be more blue sky thinking. I'll probably also state at this point that we don't pretend to have all the answers, and certainly we are hoping for some knowledge exchange during the Q&A session later on. Okay. I think these are showing the old slides, but anyway, I'll just go on. So what exactly is sharing economy? Investopedia defines it as an economic model in which individuals are able to borrow or rent assets owned by someone else. It is a very broad concept, but we're not here today to debate what it is, what it isn't, because it means different things to different people. But we want to distill the learnings from companies who have derived their operating model out of some form of sharing economy concept. Companies like Uber and Airbnb is probably familiar to most of you here today. Uber has changed the way we get around. It allows passengers to get rides from someone else for a fee. And they have also since introduced Uber Pool, a car sharing concept in some 20 markets globally, where you can share a ride with someone else. Airbnb has changed the way we travel. It allows you to rent someone else's home or room or tree houses or houseboats. And they have also since introduced experiences where you can engage in curated experiences by locals. For example, in Sydney, you can join someone surfing or you can go behind the scenes of a well-established restaurant like Rockpool. And then you have what is now known as insurtech type companies, which are trying to create change in the insurance industry. In China, there is Tongjibao. Tongjibao essentially works like a mutual, except that it does not provide the underlying insurance product. it provides a platform for members to connect to each other. What Tongji Bao does is that it creates social communities or member groups that customer joins as members. They then create a deposit account for the member. All members pay money into their deposit account, part of which is a fee for administration, and the other part is a guaranteed deposit to cover the risk being insured. All members pay the same amount into the deposit account to buy units of protection. What's interesting is the types of protection that's provided. Members can vote for the type of product they actually want. The examples of product Tongji Bao provides include divorce insurance and child safety insurance, where financial support is provided to people who have their children abducted, and ID loss protection, where financial support is provided to cover financial losses from identity theft. Members can also appeal if their claims are rejected, and the community of which they are part of can overrule the claim decline. So in many ways, you can say that Tongji Bao is going back to the roots of insurance from a few centuries ago. Insurance, at the very heart of it, is your original peer-to-peer model. In the USA, we have Lemonade, a P&C insurance company, which provides renters and homeowners insurance. They take a fixed 20% fee, and the rest will be used to pay claims and other expenses like reinsurance. Where there are excess left after paying claims, they've introduced this thing called give back, where the unclaimed excess, up to 40% of your premium, is donated to a charity of your choice, of the customer's choice. Closer to home, here in Australia, we have Trove. Currently, you can insure your electronics using a simple mobile and web interface for any length of time you want. So you can insure anything from things like your GoPro, your laptop, your Xboxes. And a side note, if there's anyone here who has first-hand experience using Trove or work in Trove, happy to hear your thoughts later on during the Q&A session. I've only listed a few examples, but there are many insurtech startups out there. You've got Friendsurance, Bought My Many, Guevara, etc. But what I really wanted to draw out here are the common recurring themes in these companies, which could very well be your next giants. When it boils down to it, all these companies are built on very simple concepts. Instead of a taxi, share your car. Instead of a hotel, share your home. Instead of a traditional insurance company and products, go back to the mutual roots of insurance. They address customer needs, either by providing alternatives to existing solutions or by creating new solutions. They have an element of social networking by connecting people who are not known to each other. Their approach to products is personalized with a diversity of choices. They create multiple touch points and not just at the point of sale. Their pricing is flexible and tailored to demand. So, there are a lot of commonalities between the companies we have just discussed and insurance as we know it today. Insurance flourishes when large networks are formed, because insurance is essentially resharing between different groups of risk. And the larger the risk pool, the better the sharing. In insurance, members contribute capital by paying premiums, which then becomes the pool of money on which all insured lives can claim on. In the non-insurance examples we've discussed, Uber drivers provide their driving services and their vehicles, and Airbnb hosts provide their home, room, and hosting guiding services. Also in insurance, new products and features tend to add vibrancy to the market. While our core insurance products have not really changed over quite a few years, many features have been added. We've got fitness tracking devices, wellness programs, severity-based trauma products, just to name a few. It's like Airbnb, where the core product of providing accommodation has not really changed, but there are now options for customers to stay in areas where hotels don't tend to be built, or to stay in unique places like treehouses or airstreams. We have all seen how prevalent Uber and Airbnb have become in the span of a few years. Can insurance ever be as popular? Or will we always be viewed as a boring need to be avoided if possible? Can we leverage on customer diversity and their different needs? Is there really a bad risk, or can they be viewed as a new opportunity? Can we introduce social networking? I'll leave you with these questions in mind as Wei Hao takes you through some food for thought on how we can look at insurance differently.
So what you see on the left is the typical insurance life cycle. So usually it starts with designing and pricing the product. You look at selling it, underwriting, policy, claims. Usually when insurers, they look at improving insurance, they would focus on one or two components, for example. So, for example, they would say, how do we underwrite better? Or how do we process claims faster? Rarely we look at changing the entire concept of insurance. So what I'm going to go through next is just some food for thought on what could be done better with the current insurance as we know it. So food for thought number one. So insurance it operates under a centralized setup. Decisions are made at the top. So what kind of policies should we be selling? What prices should we be setting? How do we define claims, for example? And then these decisions cascade down to policyholders, customers. And what happens as a result is customers feel that they're actually one person against a huge organization, and that huge organization is driven by shareholder profits. And you've got ASIC, you've got APRA, you've got ACCC who sort of are there to protect consumers in a way, but still, at the end of the day, customers will feel that they are sort of powerless to do anything. And what could change is, so rather than saying that customers are buying a policy from a large financial institution, they're actually joining a network of people with similar needs, with similar background, and they can actually communicate with one another and actually make decisions and benefit collectively. So that's number one. Number two has more to do with the nature of most insurance products. They typically involve regular premium payments, and rarely you get any claims. The majority of policyholders would just end up paying premiums and they wouldn't experience a claims event. And what that results in is customers do not really see the value of insurance. The other thing is those payouts are usually skewed towards the end of the policy term. And I was just talking about a funny example with Kwani. For example, you wanted to buy a car with the best technology, with the best features. And for example, you had to pay, say, $10,000 a year for the car for 10 years, and you only get the car at the end of 10 years. And the reason is because of that $10,000 goes towards R&D every year, and you only get the car after 10 years. And at the end of 10 years, the car may not even be relevant to you because technology might have changed after 10 years. So customers, they will sort of feel this way. Most of them would only contribute, and what could change here is having a more balanced insurance product whereby there's sort of like a give and take throughout the policy term. It could be difficult because the nature of insurance is it insures you against pretty much unlikely events. You wouldn't be able to get insurance against events which are quite likely. So it's a bit of a challenge, and what we thought is, rather than having just monetary benefits, it could be more than just that. It could be social networking, indirect benefits, which we'll discuss later. Food for thought number three. What we see is there's usually limited interaction between the insurer and the customer. Apart from the usual premium payments, we've got one or two queries, you have to make a few endorsements, and in the event of an accident, you make a claim. That limited interaction actually creates distrust between insurers and customers. Of course, you could argue the same for banks. Like, you usually just do online banking, or you would go to an ATM machine. You rarely interact with the bank itself. The issue here is, with insurance, most of the time you would be contributing money, and rarely you ever take out money. Whereas for a bank, it's a more balanced product whereby you put in money at some point in time and you would withdraw money at other times. So it's a more balanced relationship, whereas for insurance, it's more of a one-way relationship. What could change? Having more interaction between customer and the insurer over the policy term. We could even consider customer-to-customer interactions, and that leads to one of our ideas later. The last one, food for thought number four, it should be pretty much well known to everyone. Insurance is usually sold, not bought. You have to buy insurance because you're part of a super fund. It's part of your company group policy, and as a result, you don't really feel that you are proactively buying insurance. You're buying it because you have to buy insurance, and or you have to buy it because your financial advisor tells you that if something bad happens to you, your family will be suffering. So insurance is there to protect you if something bad happens. So you sort of feel that you are almost forced into that transaction rather than a proactive purchase. So all these issues are interrelated. We're looking for an integrated solution, and the aim of the presentation today is what can we learn from the giants. So one idea we had is to make it social. We all know that we've got social networking using Facebook. We've got professional networking using LinkedIn. So why don't we have insurance networking? I mean, after all, insurance is about grouping similar people. And if we have people with similar hobbies, people living in a similar location, working in a similar place, having a similar profession, and it's pretty much the same as insurance. If we introduce the concept of networking whereby people actually know one another within the same group, where they share the same risk characteristics, I mean, that in itself makes insurance a lot more tangible. They feel that they are actually part of a community with a similar risk profile. They are there to help one another out if there's a problem. We could potentially leverage on existing LinkedIn and Facebook platforms, and these platforms could be used to deliver a variety of services. And for example, Facebook, you've got this payment function whereby you can actually do either peer-to-peer payments or contribute money to a group. LinkedIn, you can post articles, you can share news about what's happening within the group. If there's something bad happening, that can be used as a platform for delivering notifications. So having that networking idea in insurance, I mean, we think it's a natural fit. And of course, you can go further. Once you have the infrastructure set up, it doesn't really matter whether you have 1,000 members in the group or whether you have 50,000 members in the group. I mean, these groups would grow over time, I mean, through, I mean, for example, referrals, whereby if I know someone who works in the same place as us, who share the same risk characteristics as us, we could invite that person to the group and simply grow that particular group. And of course, at the end of the day, you do not have to belong to just one single group. If you live in a particular place, you share a similar hobby as someone else, you could join multiple groups. There's nothing stopping you from doing that. Then there's also the concept of selective and self-underwriting, whereby because people actually know that this person joining is, for example, a safe driver, then they will be comfortable accepting him because they sort of know him personally. Then you have this concept of underwriting within the group rather than having a central underwriting authority, which is governed by a very strict underwriting process. And then, of course, there will be incentives for these groups to grow. For example, if these groups are charged with fixed expenses, then simply growing the group would allow expense efficiencies. Just taking this social networking one step further, allowing members to interact, to put in product reviews, ratings, suggestions on how to reduce risk. It doesn't have to be insurance related. if you have a group of, say, skydivers, they could share news about weather conditions, for example, where are the danger spots, where are the exciting spots, and where should they be going next for the skydiving trip. There will be incentives for these people to post. And of course, you know that if you used LinkedIn or TripAdvisor, and sometimes you do not post because of a direct incentive. People actually like to raise their profiles by posting because they would benefit. I mean, for example, if someone wanted to be heading a particular skydiving trip, if they had a high profile, they could have the chance of leaving that trip, for example. Using that platform to deliver services. Again, one interesting idea, if someone experiences an accident at the workplace, typically in insurance, that person needs to submit the claim to a claiming successor, and it goes through a pretty lengthy process. Whereas if that person was part of a network, requiring that person to, for example, nominate 5 fellow members who can validate that claim, simply because these members are, for example, family members, they were there when the accident happened, and that could actually speed up the claims process a lot. Providing disability or healthcare services, if you have doctors or physiotherapists within the group. Again, contributors will be rewarded in some way, either through premium reductions, getting money from the premium pool, or just simply raising their profile.
I'll go through a few more ideas now. So idea number 2 is about making things simple, so simplifying the purchase and the claim process. In 2017, the digital experience that customers have in other aspects of their life is quick and easy, and they're expecting that from insurers. Artificial intelligence holds the key to making things simple in a lot of cases, and I think we have heard a fair bit on AI over the past 2 days. So for example, instead of speaking to a customer service representative on the phone, customers can have an initial conversation with chatbots, who are then able to pre-populate customer data during the insurance application stage. At claim stage, the analysis of evidence, for example medical reports, which are non-standardized, can be read automatically. In recent news, JP Morgan has employed such technology to read and analyze financial contracts. At claim stage again, the rules for claims decision making can be automated to a large extent, with only complex cases escalated for human intervention. Companies such as Fukuoka Mutual in Japan and Lemonade in the USA, which we have talked about earlier, they've already started doing this. But at the same time, insurers will need to be protected from fraudulent behavior, which may surface more in a world with simplified of automated claims processes. Using data to identify patterns and signals of fraud or omissions will be key, and this is where we could also incorporate learnings from behavioral economics about human behavior. Minor tweaks can be done to induce more honest behavior. For example, customers to sign or indicate at the start instead of at the end that all claims-related information provided is true. Or using subtle reminders about fraud detection, saying something like, did you know X% of our claims can now be processed in 24 hours using cutting-edge technology to identify fraud? And identifying customers by their name repeatedly. Dear John, we are here to help you. Social experiments have shown that small tweaks like this have tend to trigger more honest answers. The third idea is to make the insurance process from purchase to claim or exit, personalised and tailored to each customer. For example, insurance statistics about how much claims have been paid, it can be shared in a way that will make it more relatable to the customers. They could get a note along with their notice to renew their policy, which tells them how much claims have been paid to people like you. So perhaps the train of thought that goes from, here's another policy renewal, what's the point of paying so much? I don't get anything anyway. It could become something like, actually, X amount of money was paid out to 40-year-old school teachers in Sydney. That could be me. Who knows what will happen to me tomorrow? We could also introduce a personalized dashboard, which gives customers an overview of the ins and outs of the insurance cover, but more on that later. A big part of personalization needs to happen between entry and exit, because this period tends to be very long for many insurance products. Insurance is typically a low engagement product and is largely viewed as a let's get in and get out as quickly as we can kind of purchase. It doesn't have to be this way. We could capture members' or customers' interest in events such as during Facebook Live events, LinkedIn career status change, or events impacting a particular member group and make meaningful contact at these points. So instead of reactive, we could be proactive and we make contact at different points for different individuals. So for example, if we had a group of members who are connected through a shared interest in running and a major marathon was coming up, they will be contacted and they'll be provided with useful information on nutrition and training in the lead up to the event or discounts for compression running tights, things like that. Another thing which could be personalized is the insurance cover itself and the payouts provided. This summit has tried to not differentiate between life and GI, and if we take that a step further, could it perhaps put aside the moral of existing products? In the Tong Chiba example mentioned earlier in this presentation, members can actually vote for the type of cover they need. So then when a product is developed and offered, you know that there will be a demand and a market for it. I want to pass this back on to Wei Hao, who will go through a few more ideas with you guys.
So there's a lot of discussion in this conference around trust from customers, and Jeff from APRA yesterday talked about trust. So customers really want the answers to two simple questions. Where's the premium going? And how do I benefit from this arrangement? So focusing on these two questions would go a long way in gaining customer trust. And one idea is to provide relevant information to customers. I mean, things like how much claims are paid out, claims which were accepted or declined, simulating the claims process, reviews on what has gone well and what hasn't. And it's not just the typical information you see in product brochures. It's more personalized, and I've got a dashboard later which illustrates this example. The other question which insurers need to think about is profitability, so making profit from customers. The first part of it is what is an acceptable profit to customers? And we all know that profit made by insurance companies are a return on shareholder funds or shareholder equity, but customers rarely accept this notion. I mean, all they see is the profit made by insurance companies. So companies need to relook at how much profit they should really be making. And we've got one example in the US with Lemonade, whereby they take a fixed 20% fee from the premium, and the rest of it is claims, and if claims experience were to be good, then that surplus is returned to charity. So it's very transparent, it's a 20% profit, and the rest is given back to the community, either in the form of claims or charity. The other thing is profit mechanism. So we all know that insurance profit is made up of many moving parts. We've got premium, we've got claims experience, investment returns. With claims itself, we've got claims from the current cohort of policies. From historical cohorts, it's affected by actuarial valuation assumptions. Again, these things are difficult to understand from the customer's viewpoint. And again, we really need to think about how can profit be explained in an easier way to customers. So here's the personalized dashboard, which, for example, the skydiver group could be getting on, say, a quarterly or annual basis. you have these kind of dashboards in Facebook or I think Airbnb, whereby you get it on an annual basis. You see things like how many people are there in your network. You can actually look at familiar faces, check out their profiles. You can see how much premium was contributed to the fund for the year. Activities which took place. So, for example, the top skydiving sites and sites which you went to. I mean, things around how much money was paid out as claims, or top causes of claims, and of course, claims experience over the past 10 years. It sort of tells you how your group has performed, where the money went, how much money was left, and it tells you, it doesn't have to be just insurance. It tells you activities which have happened, I mean, things which you need to watch out for, and probably even things to look forward to the following year. So, like what I say, similar to your year in review in Facebook and Uber, it reinforces that sense of belonging to the network, and again, it increases transparency. So, I mean, some of you might have questions around privacy. Of course, people could opt out of this dashboard if they wanted to, but our argument here is that the information here only relates to the group. It doesn't cover anyone else. It's mostly aggregated information. And the other thing is we increasingly see people being actively and willing to share personal information. Things like sharing your status, which restaurant you went to, which holiday you're going for the next month. So we feel that this actually promotes the group rather than raise privacy issues. And it might be not 100% acceptable now, but going forward, we think it's going to be a lot more acceptable. Then we've got the final idea around services-based insurance. So particularly for life insurance products, most of the payouts are fixed dollar payouts. So say $1 million if someone dies, or if we've got TPD or DI policies. What we actually see in the GI and life space is actually where there's an accident, the insurer provides services rather than money. So things like roadside assistance for motor accidents, in-house clinics if you've got a dental issue, cyber support if there was a cyber breach. I mean, we see these as being a lot more tailored for the claimants. It's actually a cost control mechanism, because if these workshops, these repair shops are too expensive, you can always elect to have other workshops. The other powerful benefit you get is actually mitigating the risk of insurance fraud. Because, I mean, for example, if someone has an accident, if all they are getting is getting the car fixed, they are a lot less likely to lodge a fraudulent claim. So the same concept can be applied to life insurance, whereby if anything happens to a person, whether he gets injured at work or there's a loss of family member, then we have all these other members within the network providing services, home support, caregiver support, can even be extended to legal, medical, financial support, and like what I said, services can be provided within the network.
So I'm just going to cover off what we've talked about today. We think insurance can be made right, and that tools that allow us to do that are already available. Customers' needs are evolving, and we as an industry need to keep up. The few things that we think we can do: introduce an element of social networking, make buying and utilizing insurance a simple or simpler process, tailor and personalize product offering and touch points, increase transparency in order to gain trust, and to provide services and not just monetary benefits. Now, a lot of what we are saying here today, or the things that we think we can do, is probably not news to you. But if there was one thing we hope you will be able to take away from today, it is the active thinking about how your experiences with other products and services in your life, how those can be adapted to make insurance right. Thank you.
Thank you for that very insightful talk. You covered not just some of the companies in the sharing economy, but also some detailed analysis on what makes them different and I guess what makes them more engaging to customers. We now have time to, I guess, throw it to you, the audience, to come forward with any questions, any examples, and discuss any points. There's a mic at the front there, so please come up, state your name and where you're from, and your question or discussion. If there isn't any from you, I might ask a question. And I think it's really fascinating, and there's some very interesting players that are coming up. But the question is, what would it take for someone like a Trove to be the next Uber or Airbnb?
So that's a really good question, Sam. I think the thing is that with a lot of these new insurtech startups, we realize that they tend to focus on just one part of the insurance value chain, because insurers tend to require a lot of capital and there are a lot of regulatory hurdles that you need to overcome. So for it to become the next Uber or Airbnb, I think to cross that line, firstly, you need a critical mass. You need people to take them up enough. So that's one big hurdle. And the next big hurdle, I think, is capital. And I think the third hurdle is regulations, that they need to be able to prove themselves to the regulators that they are safe and able to meet financial meet the obligations to customers. So I think for them to become Uber or Airbnb, you need to go through that few hurdles before you can achieve that sort of status, I guess. And even now, if you look at Uber and Airbnb, they're still fighting that sort of battles with, especially Uber, with a lot of countries where there's tension between them and the governments and things like that. I'll be happy to hear thoughts from the floor if any of you would like to share your views on, you know, how whether insurtechs can one day become the next Uber, Airbnb, or do you think that they will just become a small niche part of the insurance industry?
The other thing is it might be happening already, just that we do not realize it. So, for example, if you look at Facebook, whenever there's an unfortunate event, we actually see people offering support for either an unfortunate individual. For example, I just read the news this morning about the bombings in Manchester in the UK, and after the event, I mean, everyone was posting on Facebook or Twitter, I mean, offering support to those affected by the event. So it's sort of like insurance, whereby people help, whereby people who aren't affected help people who are affected. It's just that it's a different form. So I would say that it is happening, but it's just that we may not realize that it's some form of insurance.
Just a related point on the insurance. Actually, I'll let you.
This is Jenny from MLC. So I really like the idea of how you mentioned how social networking can actually play a really important role of making life insurance more attractive. I was thinking, so in terms of the like utilizing Facebook, that's really applicable for the younger generations. So in terms of like satisfying the needs of the older generations where they're not really into Facebook, how would you think about addressing that? If you think that's the future of what? Yeah.
So can I just ask, so how many of you in the audience do not have a Facebook account? So we've got one out of... So I might argue that this idea, I mean, like what Kwani said, it may not work straight away, but I mean, we certainly do see it becoming a very powerful tool in the next 20 or 30 years, or even the next 5 or 10 years.
And And I guess the thing is that it is not just Facebook. There are other platforms that, you know, people use for social networking. So maybe let's do another poll. LinkedIn. How many of you don't have LinkedIn? There you go. Everybody has LinkedIn. So it really, we're using Facebook as an example because it's widely used. But what we're saying is that we could introduce social networking and we don't have to build a new platform. We could leverage off existing platforms, of which Facebook is an example. LinkedIn is another one.
Ashley Palmer from Aon Hewitt. So don't worry, my question isn't to ask what Facebook is. That would be remiss as I'm being recorded. It was more just to add a comment there. I actually think that the social networking piece could have big, or is having already big implications for the elderly. And we're doing a lot of work with various aged care providers. And it's really helping to combat things like loneliness, that they've got a network both with their care provider, but with people who are also probably sitting alone at home. So I think the social networking piece does do a hell of a lot of good, and particularly for those who are vulnerable at older age.
Yes, you're right. So it doesn't necessarily need to be the elderly who need to have Facebook accounts. It's actually his or her family or his or her neighbors who are actually in the network, but helping the elderly.
I suppose the bigger risk is really like Facebook or Google basically creating their own insurance company and creating their own groupings of social networks without us as an industry driving that.
And I wouldn't be surprised because Facebook and Google, they are introducing their own payment systems. They are setting up retail platforms. So I wouldn't be surprised if they would move further into financial services.
And they do have capital, so that's one. But the other thing is also, if you think about where their competitive advantage is, so I think Google did think about insurance a few years back in the States, but I think they've closed it down 2 years ago, if I'm not mistaken. So it depends on where they think they can derive most value and whether they understand the product. So for example, now they are into the self-driving cars. So they think that's where their competitive advantage may be at. So they may become our next competitor. But before then, let's try to get up to speed.
Just one observation, and you may be aware of it and could comment more. I've heard that Airbnb has a list of owners who are willing to offer their homes as for if there was a flood or a bushfire somewhere, then there are certain owners who've earmarked that they're willing to offer their home as accommodation. I don't know if that's something that you've come across in doing the research.
Richard Lyon from TAL. I always think this kind of stuff's really exciting. It's also always harder than perhaps it ought to be. I think I'm not too scared of Facebook, Google, whatever, because I think the big turnoff for people like them is the challenge of dealing with declining claims. I don't think that's what they're in the business of doing. I think they're in the business of fulfillment. And the thing which we manage to do as an industry, for good or for ill, is both to protect people, but also to protect the value of the whole process by the way in which we manage the claims. That's a big thing to deal with. I think the soft points, the areas where we as institutions are weak, are around the reach that we have, and who controls it, and social networking is a clear, exciting prospect there. And the other is around the cost. It just costs way too much to put the business on the books and to administer it. And then there is a third, which is around the clunkiness of the service, the inability to see what you've got and to make real-time changes to it and all of that. I think too, though, that social networking, Airbnb, all these things, I think they're still, while they're huge, they're in their infancy. I don't think they're mature enough yet to be the kinds of vehicles that we think they might be. And I think what's playing out at the moment is a huge regulatory arbitrage. And a big question about what is the value of what we effectively pay for regulation. And that's going to be interesting in our space.
Thank you, Richard. Really insightful comments.
That's very insightful, Richard. Thank you. I was just going to say that we will probably see more and more of this tension, and we're seeing some of that play out already as InsurTechs, for example, gain more traction and other fintech-type institutions gain more traction.
This is Shea from Tao. Thanks for the presentation. It's very interesting. What I would like to comment on is actually, if you think about Uber, it has changed the way we use taxis. And we've been talking about Uber for a couple of years. But now people are actually talking about driverless cars. So there's always the next stage. So for us as an industry, do we really need to worry about Uber? Or should we think about the product that we're actually offering? Is it still relevant? Is it still offering, is it still relevant now and in 10 or 20 years' time when people are making a claim? So maybe instead of thinking about Uber, we should be thinking about driverless cars. That's my comment.
Yeah, so I totally agree. I mean, for example, having a traditional life insurance policy which pays someone $1 million when he dies, I mean, is that relevant in our for the modern society? So that's a question for us, I think.
We might have time for one or two questions, if there are any. Okay, we might end it there. Thanks to everyone for coming and for the questions and the discussion. Thank you particularly to our two speakers, Kuan Yi and Wei Hao. A very interesting and thought-provoking presentation to close off the concurrence for the day. You will all hopefully have downloaded the app. If you can fill out the feedback forms, that would be much appreciated. But just before we leave, please give a show of appreciation to our two speakers and a couple of gifts for you.